David Adams, the CEO of Urban Assembly, made time for this conversation because he places a premium on dialogue that is seen by both parties as an opportunity to actively listen to each other, to learn from each other, and to connect with each other in order to achieve a meaningful exchange of understanding and perspectives. From that point of appreciation of why we were connecting, David and I both agreed that dialogue at that level is ever-evolving, because in any relationship between individuals, within a community, or between different cultures, people are always changing, circumstances are always changing, and so there is always more to learn from and with each other. Next, we focused on how the group of 23 schools over which David presides works to bring the most meaningful and enriching education to underserved youth. These schools would be any parent's dream for their children's development, not only because they nurture individual skills and even hidden talents, but because they are doing the active work of prioritizing social-emotional learning for every person within each school's community. We talked about the challenges, specifically the challenges caused by this country's long history and undeniable patterns of racial injustice that gave rise to the powerful solutions manifesting every day at the Urban Assembly schools. It was a rich, rich, rewarding conversation. I trust that you will fully enjoy it as much as I did. So welcome to this, the One White Teacher podcast. My name is Nene White, and I hope you know how very, very grateful I am to be sharing this learning experience with you. Thank you for being here. And a quick reminder that I'm also making YouTubes of these conversations. So if you would like to watch and listen rather than just listen, that link is in the show's notes, right at the top of the show's notes. So there's a lot of visuals in those YouTube videos that maybe will make it a little bit more interesting for you, even more interesting. All right. Thanks for being here again. Bye. Yay. I get to talk to David Adams. Thank you, CEO of Urban Assembly. Thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure. It's nice to see you again, Amy.
Yeah, you too. So just before we started recording, we were both agreeing that this is a conversation. It's not a lecture so much as a conversation between a Black man and a white woman who seek to bridge divides without compromising who we are, but creating understanding that elevates and benefits all.
Yeah, that's a nice way to think about it, right?
Is it okay? Because I was just gonna say, is that okay?
Yeah, I had a conversation the other day with a school district in Arizona, and talked about this notion of dialogue as not the impression or the impressing of ideas to another person, but an exchange of ideas in order to find opportunities to connect and to exchange. Involves listening and it involves clarity. And I want to just make a distinction between coming into a conversation in which I have answers to questions that I am trying to impress on you and your viewers or your listeners, as opposed to my willingness to engage in a dialogue with you where we are both exploring each other's points of view on some big questions around race and equity in the United States.
Exactly. Because it's not like any one person or even any one culture would have all the answers. How can we get to them without conversation, without connecting? I mean, if we really.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
And yeah. It's not like, oh, okay, now we have the answer even. It's just like, oh, okay, now we've got one step. Now we go to the next step. Now.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's an ever evolving answer, because the question of how to be in community is a question that doesn't have one way to solve. It's like if you're living with a partner or your wife or your husband or your spouse, and you say, well, how are you in relationship with your partner? That's not a question 10 years ago, that's the same answer today, that's the same answer in 20 years, right? It's an ever-evolving movement and exchange of who you are and who they are and who you are together. And that is, I think, the crux of what we're trying to do when we're having conversations about race and ethnicity and community, is take part in that ever-evolving shift, and sometimes put energy towards that shift. And sometimes redefine that shift, or sometimes communicate what it is that we're trying to accomplish together. But just like all things are in motion, our relations to each other are in motion. And we're, I hope, having this conversation to help continue that motion towards a way that brings us in deeper community.
Exactly. And part of that would be, a piece of that would be, oh, wait, that's not the direction that's going to help us the most. Or, oh, let's explore this direction the most. And we're being kind of abstract, so let's get more concrete right away.
Eat that, and I'm with you.
Good. And I love to be abstract, but I don't want to lose anybody just by the floating away. So, yeah. So you are the third CEO of Urban Assembly?
I am.
Okay. Which is a family of schools committed to anti-racism, which started in New York City how many years ago?
We started about 1992. So I think 27 is the date.
Okay. So, and it's reasonable to assume that that commitment, that the Urban Assembly is committed to anti-racism, and that's really the starting point for the schools. Is that correct or not?
I mean, I'd say our mission statement talks about that the Urban Assembly enhances this economic and social mobility of young people by improving public education. And part of that improving public education is a commitment to justice and a commitment to justice for all students. And so to the extent that racism is not a commitment to justice, it's a commitment to an ideology that doesn't give access to justice to all Americans or to all young people. That's something worth looking at in the context of education. This is what we do, understanding how improving public education improves opportunities and justice for all young people.
Were there some events, or was there a trend or something that was happening in New York City that made it so, okay, we need to create urban assemblies? There must have been a build of something.
Yeah, I mean, so the Urban Assembly started because a courthouse was being built in the Bronx, and the community had really rallied together to say that the dispensing of justice was one part of society's obligation, but the development of young minds was an obligation that was not being met. So the graduation rate in New York City at the time was around 48% across the city, and the Bronx was lower. Some schools as low as 20 or 30% of students were graduating. And so the community came together and put together a demand for schools, for structures of environment and society that invested in young people's ability to contribute, so that we weren't just investing in the repercussions of a lack of contribution to our people, but that we were investing in urban people itself. And so the Bronx School for Law, Government and Justice actually included a courthouse, a mock courthouse for young people to participate in this notion of justice and this notion of law and justice, and develop the kind of minds that could contribute to our society rather than just sanction those who struggle to do so.
So proactive added to the reactive challenges that were going on in New York City.
Yeah, I mean, we believe, we know that a high quality education is the most important input into our young people. I mean, if you think about our societal resources, education and public education is one of, if not the highest amount of investment that we make as a society. If you look at local taxes and state taxes and federal taxes, our public education system is the highest investment that we make in our young people. And the obligation there is by investing in our young people, they will be prepared to invest back in society. And that this school, your Urban Assembly School for Law, Government, and Justice, was an incarnation of that investment. And it was a demand of community activists at the time that if they're going to build a courthouse, that they would build a school, and that school would be of a quality that no courthouses need to continually to be built, because we did not do part one of our obligation to society, which is develop the faculties and the minds of young people so they can contribute, not be arrested and sent to court.
Like, make the problem go away so that you don't need that kind of a solution. Yeah,
I mean, it's the promise of education. And yeah. We hold ourselves to the standard to live to that idea and that ideal. And the better we do, the more honest investments we're making, the less likely we will have to build courthouses because we're building schools.
Okay, so now the Urban Assembly has this full range of schools that focus in different areas of life that can bring this enrichment to our whole country, to our whole society, to our whole world. And the focus areas are just as big as it gets. So which ones would you like to focus on? Tell us more specifics about them.
I mean, I think we got great schools.
Yeah, you do.
We got schools that focus on performing arts. We are the only unscreened or unauditioned performing arts school in New York City. So identified a long time ago that not all students have opportunities to develop their musical talents in a private way that would allow them to pass these screens and auditions.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that they don't have something to contribute to the musical space. And so we opened up a school for performing arts that students who wanted to participate and develop their skills in this space could do so, not be excluded. We have schools focused on design and construction, where folks, young people are investing in this notion of how we create space and how we organize space to serve needs and to solve problems. And that's working with industry partners, School for Collaborative Healthcare. And we know healthcare is a huge issue that has been for the last 2 years, in particular the pandemic. So these schools are really focusing on giving students opportunities to not only know, but to do by participating in career internships and work-based learning opportunities in hospitals. So they can take the skills that they learned in class and really practice and develop them with real people, with real feedback. We have schools like Harbor, the Billion Oyster Project, who are working to look at the ecosystem and replenish it with oysters and making sure that the ecosystem is on Governor's Island in New York City, and make sure that we are reinvesting in our environment by enabling our young people to solve problems. So, I mean, I got a list of 23 schools needed, and I got a story for each one of them.
I'm sure.
But they're all organized around opportunities for our young people to develop identities that allow them to contribute to their societies and their communities through developing skills, ways of knowing, and ways of being.
And do the kids get to choose, I want to go to Harbor or I want to go to, okay. So
there's a huge, complicated system in New York City around matching schools. I couldn't even explain to you how and where these algorithms work. But I do know, and I will say that we are very proud that our schools are open to all children. They're what we call unscreened here in New York City, which means that there is no test. There is no requirement around attendance. There is only young people who benefit from a high quality education being matched to a school who is dedicated to providing that education for young people.
Okay. And one of the things that I've noticed and appreciate so much and just, you know, pray that this country will adopt more of it, because if not, we are in terrible shape, is this idea of emphasizing critical thinking for kids. I mean, and that questions are a huge part of the curriculum. So could you talk about that, questions, why that is so emphasized, and the critical thinking piece?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's clear to folks who've been really following the educational literature that we learn in community, and that when we are pushing against each other's thinking, it refines our arguments, it grounds our ability to provide evidence, it elevates our communication skills. We solve problems in groups. And so the role of questions is to elevate and to inspire our thinking. When we ask deep and rich questions, we can set our kids loose to investigate these questions and develop their faculties as they do so. And so the better the questions we ask, the deeper the learning will be. The deeper the learning will be, the more robust the skills associated with those learnings are. So we care about questions because questions are what drive our learning. And I've got an 8 and 9 year old, and he comes and he asks me questions. My two boys, which we have family dinner night, and they just got questions about the world, you know? And I think that's what it's about. That's what it's about. And when we recognize that observation and questioning refines the skills that we're looking for that are academic, right? We hold on to that theme and that thread of investigation that moves into problem solving and work, problem solving in relationships, problem solving in society. Again, it's just about these kinds of questions. How do you want to live in community as a governance question around problem solving in society? How can we design a product given these constraints, which is a problem solving question that you might have in a workplace? How do we get from point A to point B, given our fuel ratio of 1:1:3? That might be a question that you have to solve if you were an air traffic person or a fuel or logistical manager in an airport. So questions are what drive thinking, and that's what we care so much about it.
And I'm always kind of interested too in difficult questions, personal questions, questions that are hard and that around topics that are challenging and that hurt to consider. But is there a possibility for that in the schools? And how is that nurtured between the faculty, so that the faculty has the skills, the courage, the will to take on that kind of a challenge, to help kids really move forward in the stuff that a lot of places they're not even allowed to talk about, like the laws in Oklahoma where you can't talk about racism, you know. Are there mechanisms for that in your schools?
You know, I mean, I think, Nina, we talked about this concept of social emotional learning and the social emotional dimensions of learning, the social emotional dimensions of thinking and problem solving, right? We are seeking to understand truths about the world and ourselves. And if you think about, like, let's just use an example of Galileo, who looked up at the world and then looked up at Jupiter and said, you know, I think our understanding of who and how the world works is off. And yeah, he developed all this evidence and he pulled it in, and people were just like, oh, wow, that's uncentering the role of humanity, and that does not feel. And, you know, there was the church, but also just regular people like, I want to be the center of the universe. It's like, I got it. I understand we all have that impulse. And constrained human understanding for hundreds of years, right? that impulse to say that I want to feel important constrained our understanding of ourselves and the world and the universe.
Yeah.
And so I think we need to develop the social emotional faculties of our young people in the same way that we develop the cognitive faculties, because it all involves problem solving. It all enhances, it all facilitates problem solving.
Yes.
And allows us to see truths, right? Truths exist. And the earth revolves around the sun. and that is a truth. Or at least it is a truth today based on the evidence that we have, including satellites and pictures and such and so forth, right? And so the best minds are incorporating our cognitive, our reasoning, and the social emotional aspects of reasoning help us to solve problems effectively. And when we don't talk about things that are difficult, whether it's critical race theory or notions of the relationship of our history and our racial history in the United States, or it's whether or not the earth revolves around the sun or vice versa, there are truths to be had and to be known. And things that constrain our ability to see the truth constrains our forward progress as humans and society. I think as an educational field and educational people, we should remove as many constraints as possible from understanding the truth, because that's what's moving our society forward.
And yes, and probably one thing that we could say determines some people's determination to put up those constraints is a fear of not being the center of the universe, not being on top of the pile, not having the privileges, being replaced. Mm-hmm. All of those fears, because there's diversity now, there's truly equal rights, there's truly equality, and there's this educational spur that's bringing these kids that have been disadvantaged so far to have the kinds of education that will make them equal with me. Why should I not be afraid of that? Why should I not want to constrain that? I don't, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're not yet equal. Right. In a society,
right. But
I think we have come to a consensus that equality is worth pursuing in a true sense, not just on paper, and it takes a confidence.
It takes a confidence
that says that competition produces the best version of ourselves. And so to constrain folks from competing is to reflect a sense of insecurity around one's own ability to compete.
In truth, absolutely.
And I believe that as we continue to move forward, folks will continue to understand that equal footing for competition benefits us all, because it allows the best and brightest minds to contribute all that they have to our society. I think talent is not a widely distributed attribute. And the idea that we would not allow the talented of us and the most talented of us to contribute those talents, I think is a very short-sighted way to move forward as a society. And again, it does mean that one is not the center of the universe in the same way that Galileo looked at the sun and the Jupiter and made these attributions.
Mm-hmm.
But in return for that truth,
mm-hmm.
We gain an understanding of our true place in the universe and the universe itself. And so I would say, in return for the truth that there is talent distributed across people and across genders and across different attributes, we gain the forward progress of society for being able to tap those talents effectively. And while the bitter bird of resentment that is imbibed through racism fed many for a long time, it was not nutritious. And it's not nutritious.
Yeah.
And
to anyone.
Yeah. To anyone. So I would offer that sustenance is through developing our ability to contribute all that we can to our communities. And that sustenance supports us. It supports our neighbors, it supports our country, and it's nutritious. It fills us up. It allows us to build our systems. It's true food. It's not something that feels like food, but in fact deprives us of the nutrition we need to be successful.
And so, thank you for that. Then there are the cultural differences besides the melanin and the non-melanated elements, where our cultures are different. Like one time I was at a Juneteenth celebration in Georgia, and I was pretty much the only Black woman there. And the kids were so loud.
Woman. Huh? White woman. White woman there.
What did I just say? Black woman?
Yeah.
Okay. The only white woman. And thank you for correcting that. And I was totally loving it. But I realized that you know, we're all different. And those kids, I prayed for boys. So I'm comfortable around the loud and the raucous. But I know that some people just really aren't. And so how do we help people get beyond the philosophical of, yes, we aren't the center of the universe. And yes, we all benefit by not constraining anyone. How do we help people to live with that? I mean, is there an answer even? I don't know, because, you know, we're different. We're different, and it's beyond just looking. Do you see where I'm trying to go with this? I want to help people acknowledge those differences and their discomfort with them sometimes, but to what needs to happen to be able to get past their biases, get past their initial responses to those cultural differences that are there, you know, without being judgmental, because I have to catch myself on that. And with time I've gotten better, but it took some, you know, oh, wait a minute, I'm going there. That doesn't help anything. I need to go see if I need to see if I can go there. Can I? You know, I mean, okay, I've talked enough.
Yeah, I mean, I think.
And are there things that, you know, are, you know, hard for you as a Black man to get past in dealing with the white culture that are just uncomfortable, besides the rude things that we do to Black people? Are there things, you know, do we need to understand what it's like from your perspective? But yeah.
I mean, I think we are multifaceted people. In the United States in particular, has reduced us to the racial facet as the only facet that matters, right? Yeah. But it's an important facet. I think it's something that drives opportunity. But it's not the only thing that makes us who we are.
Right.
And I think when we have narratives that build superstructures to our identity, whether that's the military, whether that's occupations, whether it's sports teams, these binding, cohering mechanisms.
Yes.
I think we can see each other in ways that connect us. And this is why segregation was such an important element of keeping us disconnected, because because when folks don't experience each other and they find it very hard to connect.
Yes.
I think that there are a lot of things that connect people. But it takes time and it takes effort and it takes will to figure out what those are.
Yes.
And to the extent that we are living in a country that is segregated, and schools that are segregated, it's unlikely that we're going to find the experiences that allow us to build those connections and those narratives. I think when folks don't see each other in community, it becomes easy to create narratives about them.
Yes.
That undermine our ability to see ourselves in each other. So to the extent that I think we are in communities and in proximities, we can figure out something that reminds us of ourselves and each other. And that could be emotional, it could be, you know, I had a brother once and he used to yell at me, and you did too, that's really interesting, or it could be occupational, it could be many things. And I think it's interesting to me the role segregation continues to play in denying Americans opportunities to see each other and to experience each other. And I think that is a big challenge to building a sense of community and building a sense of coherence. And I think folks who continue to think about our country in ways that exclude all of its citizens benefit from the continuation of practices that don't allow us to experience each other and see ourselves in each other.
I was with some people a couple of nights ago, and someone made a statement that I absolutely loved, very brief, very quick. He said, "I don't learn when I'm only around sameness. I only learn from differences. I only learn and grow from differences." So, I hope I'm not saying anything rude or inappropriate here, you know, but this is something that, you know, hurts my heart. And I'm sure in your own way, it hurts yours, this forced separation that is so non-beneficial to all of us, keeping us in those silos of sameness that is really quite boring after a while.
Yeah, it's interesting because I travel a lot, you know, or used to pre-COVID. And what's interesting to me is the perspective you gain on yourself when other people observe you from different contexts. So like, what does it mean to be American? I spent a year in England.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lot of perspective that I didn't have when I traveled. My mother's from Haiti. What does it mean to be American in the context of being in Haiti? And so, you know, I think diversity gives us this perspective. It allows us to see things from different kinds of angles. And those angles help us to understand, again, ourselves in the world, right? It's just very hard to tell a fish that they're in an ocean. And it's very hard to understand things that are obvious to you or not obvious to you. And the same thing with class. So I went to basic training 2002. It's got to be 19 years ago now. Yeah, 20 years ago. Yep, 20 year mark. And I remember there was this soldier, I don't remember where he was from, but I remember his name, serving with, and we had just gotten our, what they call class A's in the Army, which are the green uniforms, like with your tie, and he said, this is my first suit. And I said, oh, this is your first Army suit, right? He's like, no, this is my first suit, period. And he'd come from a rural background, a white guy. And I just didn't have a perspective to understand what it meant to be white and poor, because I had not seen it, understood it, experienced it. Right. And he's a lot poorer than I was. You know, I had at least two suits because I had a church suit and, like, you know, my house, we called them church suits and church shoes. And I, like, I had to associate all those things with church because that's how we dressed up.
Yeah.
But that's perspective. Right? You don't understand what you don't know.
Right. You don't know what you don't know. You don't know what you don't know. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's it. I would say the diversity thing to me, a diversity conversation. I mean, folks who are, one of the reasons cities are more innovative than rural areas is because they have access to ideas. Their cities are typically on ports. Ports usually have travelers and traders. Travelers and traders bring not just stuff, but concepts. And those concepts integrate with the concepts that exist. And if you contrast that with rural spaces, it's not a critique of rural spaces.
Right.
They have a lot less access, if they're landlocked or something, right, to ideas. Now you got books, you got the internet, you have all these different ways now, right? But the reason why a city is a vibrant exchange of ideas, even if it's on a river, when we think about Chicago, right? Coming through the river, as people debarked, they came with ideas, ways of solving problems, ways of understanding the world. They're not all good, but they are ways.
Right.
And so diversity to me continues to be about ways of solving problems. I'm fascinated by this idea that nature has two ways of reproducing. You got your asexual and sexual reproduction, right? You think about how much effort sexual reproduction takes. Think about it. Let's just talk about a zebra, right? Or let's go with a lion. You gotta find a mate. You gotta fight off the other lions. You gotta sexual reproduction. Then the cells have gotta reproduce and exchange 23, chromosomes and 23 chromosomes, and they gotta get together, create this whole new thing. I mean, you know, you got tapeworms and things. They just reproduce. You know, clone themselves and call it a day. And yet, like nature has said, given these two ways of reproducing, it's clear that the most preferred way is to intersect one's genes with another person's genes in order to create new versions of life, because that's the way that nature has identified through natural selection that we solve problems, right? That the ability to produce new versions with new permutations of these genetic sequences creates more effective life than just reproducing the same thing over and over and over again. Right. So if it's good enough for nature, it's good enough for me. diversity is worth the effort.
Yeah.
And I think that's what the natural world shows us. Diversity is worth the effort. And in our own communities, I would say the same thing. Diversity is worth the effort. And not just racial diversity, but diversity of class, folks from really different ways of understanding the world in terms of socioeconomic backgrounds, diversity of region. I'm from the Northeast. I've learned over the time that Northeast is like a powerhouse in the United States of like capital and thinking and influence. I didn't know that. I just thought it was New Jersey and New York, right? But like when I'm not in New Jersey and New York, people are like, oh, you're from New Jersey.
Yeah.
That has meaning.
Yeah.
It's different from being from Kansas. Not better.
Or California.
Or California, another area, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
These are all the things that if you don't know what you don't know, then it's going to be hard to understand the problem. And diversity allows us to create solutions to problems in different kinds of ways because we're connecting and we are
learning what we don't know that we don't know.
Learning what we don't know that we don't know.
Through that diversity. And
it's hard. I mean, I think like people are like, oh, diversity. Like, yes, obviously. But like, think about it. Diversity is harder than asexual reproduction. It's right. harder. Right. All these things that you have to do, right? You got to attract a mate. You got to have flowers that have bright colors and birds. It's just much more effort. And yet most species do go through that effort because that's the way that they create their fitness. That's the way that they maintain their ability to adapt to environments and situations.
Fascinating. Fascinating. I love it. I don't know what more we can say about this fear element, but I know it's deep in our culture that it's, and the media stokes it in one way or another, and it's stoked in all kinds of ways. I don't know if you can say anything more about that, if you've said enough, but it just,
I mean, I
you
think
know, I just.
Charleston, there's the chant was, they will not replace us in Virginia.
Right.
So, I mean, this is a fear that is real. Right. And I want to say it was Jefferson Davis who said that if the North won the Civil War, I can't quote him off the top of my head, but Black people would dominate white people in the way that white people had been dominating Black people to date. But I would answer to this is that we are self-governing as a people. We are a democracy, and so. The fear of being replaced, I think it needs to be tapered by this notion that we are communities. And because a community did one thing to another person doesn't follow necessarily that those communities will do the same back, especially if we took the time and care to learn about our history in a way that allows us to do better.
Exactly.
So we are trying to build.
Oh, I'm sorry, could you say that again?
Oh, I don't know.
Oh my God, that is so important. That just because one culture did something to the other culture, that doesn't necessarily mean that once that other culture that has been oppressed rises, it doesn't mean that it would, especially if they took the lessons of history. What did you say?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, Bishop Desmond Tutu just recently passed away. And the notion of truth and reconciliation committees, right? We are trying to do better as a humanity to answer the question of how to move forward from pain. And it's not to say that that's the only methodology is to articulate your shame and your pain and allow for forgiveness and grace to enter into the conversation. But I know we are trying. We are trying to investigate how to break these cycles of violence. And we're gonna continue to try and do that. In the same way, I think Martin Luther King was able to identify nonviolent protest as a mechanism to move social progress through some of these challenges by focusing on what violence does to both communities. I mean, I think if you look at Dr. King and his ideas and based on Gandhi, I mean, this notion of what does it take to maintain this structure? It takes turning fire hoses on children. It takes women berating five-year-olds who want an education. It takes dogs being turned on women. It takes men being hung in trees around picnics. And that's what it takes. And I think when we understand that that is what it takes to maintain these systems, it's my hope that we would not reproduce those systems in order to maintain a new version of that, right? So I think this notion of fear is a fear that folks will do to them what they have done to others. But I think in the Christian ethos, right, and then also in the humanistic kind of tradition, what we're trying to understand is how to forgive and how to offer grace and how to do better than what was done to us.
And to not get stuck in the past, because then you're stuck and you can't really move into the life that you could be preparing for, but with all your energy, you're going for revenge. And the Black people that I have spoken to, and at this point, I've spoken to quite a few on this podcast, which I'm so grateful for. All I have seen is a very clear-headed sense of solutions-oriented and solutions being big picture and, you know, just let's move forward. Okay, the past was the past, and we are with the residual of it today, but we don't have to stay in that mindset and continue in that paradigm of, yeah.
Yeah, it's attention. It's attention, yes. Because much of our current state is reflective of the laws, the policies, the actions, the violence that were visited upon Black people and continue to be visited upon Black people. And yet we need to create the energies to envision a future that has justice in it for all folks. I feel grateful that my ancestors had the vision to endure so that they could imagine a country that treated Black people with the dignity that the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution promised. And then the Dred Scott decision obviously nigged on. I just imagine arguing Brown versus the Board of Education to overturn Plessy versus Ferguson with the belief that the institutions of the United States, so plagued with racism as they were and are, could be called upon to grant dignity to the educational process of Black children by overturning a separate but equal standard. I mean, imagine what it takes to fight in World War I and World War II for a country that lynched people in uniform upon return, and still having the belief in these concepts and these institutions. So I think the cynical version of this argument does a disservice to those who brought us and delivered us in the space. Those who did fear the dogs and brave the dogs and brave the lynch mobs and brave the police and brave these systems to deliver on this promise of justice and equity. And much more troubling and oppressive conditions than we are in today and in a community. So yes, I'd say the cynical, we can never do better, is not an argument that is evidenced by the history of those who made us do better. And believed in a country that could live up to its values and ideals, and then gave their lives to make that country a reality. So that's the tension, right? We recognize that much of the current state is a reflection of how Black people were and are viewed, but in a way that our ancestors believed that there was a version of this country that could be better, that could be moving towards a more perfect union. I believe that that is the energy that we need to take forth in order to identify the structures that we need to perfect the union.
In these conversations, there's a part of me that still is in awe and can't understand how that mindset of that holding that higher vision after all of the dark experiences that have been put upon people, how they can hold that high vision. I mean, I know in my own heart, with the challenges that I've had in life, I have been able to do that in a lot of ways, but somehow or another, I don't know how other people can do it with the impossible challenges that many of which you just described, but I'm going to keep trying, and I am always in awe of it, and deepest respect and appreciation and gratitude, because it is that sense of possibilities that is lived by people like you that keeps people like me being able to move forward. And so I am intensely grateful and respectful of you and your time and your actions, and with all my heart. Let's see. Is there anything else that we want to talk about? I mean, there is just, I would just talk to you forever and a million times every day of the week, but I'm just so grateful for your time now. Is there anything else that we could talk about? How you got to be the CEO of Urban Assembly? I think that's a very interesting story. How proud are your parents of you? What did they do? And what kind of, you know, stepping stones were there where you could have gone this way or that way? And you know, just kind of that juicy, meaty stuff that helps us.
You know, I don't know, Nini. I feel blessed to have an opportunity to serve. And I feel like a life well led, from my perspective, is a life that builds something and a legacy for my children to hold on to. And that as a stepping stone that I use to be in this position, when my children look at me and say, my father left stepping stones for others. Mm-hmm. I feel very blessed to be in a position to serve and to contribute to the forward motion of our country and forward motion of my community, forward motion of education. Those are things that are very, very important to me, and an honor to be in a position to hopefully, when I pass away, have left something for others to hold on to.
And in the other podcast, we were talking about social emotional learning. Is there anything more that you want to say, like specifically how it's combining the racial elements of interactions that these kids who are getting career and college and community ready, how their social emotional learning combines all of that, specifically, if you can, like take the most, like the science or the technology or the computer tech, or how do they bring that social emotional learning element into their learning experiences?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think social emotional skills, to me, are like letters of an alphabet. We teach skills, like how A sounds, and then we help young people understand the relationship between A and a consonant like T. And they use these things to put together words and they put together sentences, and then they start to write their ideas using these skills. And social emotional skills is the same process in which we teach these skills like listening and perspective taking and management and self-management and social awareness. And then we watch young people deploy them to write their own understanding of what they're trying to accomplish in the world. So whether that's perspective taking and using human-centered design and using design thinking to understand how to organize problems and solutions for a new phone, or sitting in a school board meeting, trying to understand, and as a school board member, and organizing curriculum that allows young people to understand themselves in the world through listening, taking multiple values together and synthesizing them into a consensus that people can get behind. Those are social emotional skills being used in that context. Or just sitting on a podcast with a wonderful woman and exchanging ideas around the notion of race and of the future of our country. So we teach the skills and then our young people deploy them in ways that help them solve the problems they care about.
Relevance and listening. Listening are huge. Those are two key elements I keep hearing in all of this.
Let's talk about SEL Day.
Okay.
So on March 11th, we have SELday.org, or we have SEL Day, I should say. You can sign up on SELday.org, okay. Hashtag SEL Day.
Okay.
And folks from across the country and really across the world can participate in elevating this notion of finding common ground through social emotional skills. So you can sign up on SELday.org and you can promote SEL, you can elevate SEL, you can do a podcast around social emotional learning, you can write a editor, you can get a proclamation from your town or your state around social emotional learning. Whatever you want to do, you can do it. And you sign up on SELday.org, you make a commitment. And once you sign up, you say, I'm going to do one of these five things. You can host an event. And last year, we actually had 14 million impressions, 14 million interactions around SEL Day. Whoa. We had 7 state proclamations, including places like Texas and New Jersey and Connecticut. We had the House of Representatives read SEL Day into their official record as March 29th. And this year, we want to do more. And our theme this year is focused on building common ground or finding common ground, pursuing the common good. And we're going to talk about, and we want you all to talk about, how you're using SEL skills to find common ground and pursue the common good. So again, if you sign up on SELday.org, choose a commitment, and then get your friend involved, and then get your friend's friend involved. And if we all do this, we can elevate the work for social emotional learning. Mm-hmm. We can help find common ground. We can encourage people to pursue the common good. And you all can be part of this forward motion as who we are as a country and who we are as a society. And we can use SEL skills to make it happen.
Well, there's nothing but good in that. I love the concept of common ground. I'll just love to end on that. I mean, common ground is that. It's common ground. There's no winners or losers in common ground. Do you want to say anything about that, or is that self-evident?
Yeah, look, I had a conversation the other day. We talked about what the common good was, right? And this is notion of doing for some what we would do for all because of the reciprocal nature of the relationship, mm-hmm. right? So the only way to identify your common good is to be in community. Mm-hmm. And the only way to be in community is to have shared concepts and beliefs that cohere us. And a notion of reciprocity that I want for you, what I want for myself, what I want for your children, what I want for my children. So that's the work that's facilitated by social emotional skills, but also things that we were talking about, things like policies that help desegregate schools, folks and opportunities for folks to experience each other in a sense of parity. And that's the work I hope to help elevate through our opportunity on March 11th and SEL Day.
Thank you, David.
Oh, you're welcome, Mimi.
All my best to your family and to, yeah. Thank you very, very much.
You're very welcome.
Be sure to check the show's notes for links and a little bit of help with the information that David suggested that you take advantage of for SEL Day. Okay, thank you again for being here.